All right, all right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a jam-packed show for you today, one that you're not going to forget for quite some time. At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to an excerpt from a speech that Bob Avakian gave back, back in 2003, 2004, and it was a speech called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And he's talking about why do people from all over the world come to this country anyway, all right? So you don't want to miss that one. Before that, we'll be listening to an interview that I did with Georgiana Williams. Georgiana Williams is the mother of Damian Williams, and Damian Williams was one of the LA Four, the four youth that were arrested for participating in what happened at Florence in Normandy during the earliest hours of the LA Rebellion. And these four youth were tried, convicted, jailed, and these youth were used as a target by the system to hit back at the rebellion itself. Well, I talked with Georgiana Williams about her views on the attempts to pit black people and immigrants against each other. So you don't want to miss that one, all right? And before that, you'll be listening to a song, a very special song that we managed to find from Gil Scott-Heron. It was on his album 1980. And the name of the song is Alien, Hold On to Your Dreams. All right, that's going to be an exciting one for people who are fans of Gil Scott and who have been actually really wanted to hear something as refreshing and soul-stirring as this piece. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be. And opening the show up, we are going to be listening to an interview I did a short while ago with Margaret Regan. Margaret's the author of Detained and Deported, Stories of Immigrant Families Under Fire. So you got the sense of it. It's going to be a jammed show, an exciting show. And let's just jump right into it now with my discussion with Margaret Regan.
I'm really pleased to be welcoming to the show my next guest. And this is Margaret Regan. And Margaret wrote a book that somebody actually pulled my shirt tail on it. They said, look, check this book out. You've got to. I'm starting to read it. It's just knocking me back in my seat. And I picked the book up and I started reading it, and quite literally, I read it, and I spent an entire day reading it, and I just didn't want to stop, and I went from beginning to end and was extremely moved by this book, and it's the story of immigrants in the U.S. and in the entire North and Central America. You know, what's happening there? What's the story? And it's actually, I felt, and we'll talk with Margaret about this in a minute, but I felt that this was really a story that in this book, the thing that really, really holds on to you is that it's a constant struggle between the dehumanization of all these human beings that are forced to leave their home, to leave everything they know by the conditions there and come to a place they know nothing about and desperately seeking to survive, or once they've been there, to stay here, versus what actually is the system that's actually bent on and constantly finding new ways to dehumanize all these people. And that was a theme that I think really, really, you know, winds through this entire book and in very creative and very moving ways. So, Margaret, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Michael. That was a wonderful introduction. I appreciate it.
Good. It was a wonderful book, sister. Really wonderful. I meant it clearly. I couldn't stop. I couldn't put it down until I finished it.
Wow.
So, it was, yeah. Let's tell people exactly what the book is about.
Okay, well, it kind of comes out of a previous work. I wrote a book 5 years ago about the deaths of immigrants in the Arizona desert, which is a huge issue here in, I live in Tucson, and I'm a reporter here in town, and so I started writing about these deaths long about 2000, and a book came out in 2010 called The Death of Joceline about how many people are dying. They're still dying out there. We're up to close to 3,000 bodies found in the last 15 years, which is a lot of bodies in just an American state, right, to find these bodies lying around on public lands often. But after that, you know, I learned some things when I was reporting on that book. I started learning about the detention centers, and I started meeting migrants on the border who, they were not first-time crossers. These were people who had lived in the United States for a long time and had families here and had been deported. And they're stuck across the other side of the border trying to get back home. So I decided to investigate this whole issue of people who did successfully cross the borders many years ago, have lived these very American lives, often have American citizen children, and then something happens, you know, some small event, they're driving with their taillight out or something on that level often, and they get caught. Their lives are upended. They're sent to these detention centers, which have appalling conditions. And eventually many of them were deported, and many, many of them are separated from their children. So it's a huge and ongoing issue. It's kind of like this is the immigration story now, the fact that so many people are living here and this crisis is affecting them every day. And as you said, they live in fear, the ones who haven't been caught, that, you know, one day maybe their light will go out on the back of their car.
Yeah, you know, and it's very heavy because when you lay this out in terms of the scope and the situation that people are facing, I mean, I am someone who has paid attention to this. At the same time, when I looked at the actual numbers and the scope, the breadth of this, I was stunned. And I want to, yeah, can you tell people, like, I want people to get a sense of, like, this, we're talking about so many millions of people. And you divide your book up into detention and deportation. And when you add all of those figures together, this, and even with the taking into account the overlap, we're looking at a story of millions of people per year who are caught up in this and being eaten by this machinery.
Right. Well, typically in a single year, we have about 400,000 people cycling through the detention centers, not all being held at one time. We usually have about 35,000 being held on a given day. But over the course of a year, 400,000 people being brought there. And approximately, you know, equivalent to that, about 400,000 being deported and what they call it, formal removal every year. So, yeah, close to 1 million people affected in some way every single year. And then, you know, the numbers add up as you go on. I think Obama is up to, and, you know, he's been in office for what now, 7 years almost, you know, his numbers are up to about 2 million deported. And, you know, that's been true with the previous presidents also.
You know, there's something, Margaret, that is really I was going to say this to the end, but I really want people to get this. The way you open up your book, I think it captures exactly what you're saying. You have this position. I mean, these are people, again, these are people who are just, they're looking for a way to stay alive. And it's like everything has been so screwed up, mainly by the workings of the economies of this society and what goes on with all this. And there's no work, NAFTA destroying all this stuff, in Mexico, and, you know, people just not being able to live in the ways that they did. And you present something in the beginning of the book that I found to be, again, sort of sucked me in right away. You presented this when I was talking about the constant tension between the humanity of the people and the constant assault on that humanity through the system and the people that defender or the enforcers of the system. You start with a beautiful portrait of what goes on at that wall. Can you just give people a sense of your take on that? It was a very poetic sense of that.
The wall.
Yeah, it's important.
Yeah, we're so used to this wall down here in Arizona. Yeah, it's this amazing thing. Every day you see lines of people being marched back over the border into Nogales. And then one of the most poignant things is, you know, a few years ago they built a great big new stronger wall. They had a fairly flimsy thing. It was, and this is a poetic metaphor also, the original wall was made out of helicopter landing flats that had been used in the Persian Gulf War and in Vietnam. It was army surplus. But they were just these sort of junky-looking metal things. And 2011, the government decided to build these really thick, tall posts. These walls now go up about 20, 25 feet. But they wanted the wall to be see-through, so they have 6 inches in between these posts. You can't get through it. But the Border Patrol wanted to be able to see who was on the other side, if somebody was planning to try to climb over. It just gives them more information if they can see what's going on in Mexico. But one of the side effects of this has been that families meet between the wall. I witnessed, you know, a father on the American side. You know, he's in America. He goes down there to visit his wife and children. Little boy handing his school paper through the bars to his father. It's very heartbreaking. That wall is an improvement for families like that. But there's also a downside. We do have a case in which a Border Patrol agent stuck his gun through that see-through wall and shot a 16-year-old boy on the Mexican side. And that happened more than 3 years ago now. And right now there's a case going on. His mother has sued the federal government. They argue that because this did not take place in the United States, the death of the boy didn't take place in the United States, they don't have jurisdiction and nobody can be prosecuted. So the mother is challenging that in court right now. So.
It's interesting, too, though, because when you think about that, all the people, they just came out with some kind of decision. I can't remember who made it, whether it was the Border Patrol or the government, some branch of the U.S. government, that there's been so many shootings along the border.
Yeah.
No one's held responsible. It's all like, well, we can't prosecute anybody. You know, sorry, this is, it was all in the line of duty, you know, which is like,
I know. If you think about it, if it were reversed, if a Mexican law enforcement officer aimed his gun through there and shot a 16-year-old kid in Arizona, you know, it would be a big international incident.
Mm-hmm.
But it's amazing. Yeah, the Border Patrol is kind of notorious. You know, it's kind of parallel. We're learning a lot about the police in American cities right now with all these cases that we've been hearing of police fatal shootings of people on the streets. The Border Patrol has an amazing record of killings that they're always exonerated. Invariably, they're exonerated, and very few of them really get investigated to any level.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to talk about that in a minute. I wanted to also, though, go into this detention centers that you talk about, in which, to me, you know, look, I considered myself, okay, I know enough about this, or I know quite a bit about it, but not, and as your book pointed out, not nearly enough, because these detention centers, while I knew they existed, the scope, the magnitude of the repression that goes on inside the centers, but the scope of the centers themselves, the fact that they are all over the place, and then with this concentration in Arizona, which, you know, okay, what are we going to do about Arizona, huh?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, somebody wrote a book, The Trouble with Kansas. I guess we need another one, The Trouble with Arizona.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was the same way when I started hearing about this. There are about 250 different detention centers around the United States. And one of the things that's the most astonishing about it is that we, the people of the United States, don't really operate them. Many, many, many of them are run by private prison companies under contract to the U.S. government. Partly because, you know, this whole industry grew so quickly, you know, the government can't possibly afford to build its own. But these ones run by the private prison companies, that's Corrections Corporation of America and the GEO Group, they're in the prison business. They're used to dealing with criminals, convicted criminals, felons, and so on in their private prisons. And that's their model. And these detention centers are not supposed to be punitive prisons. They are supposed to be civil detention, meaning people are not being held for a criminal punishment, but they're being held simply to assure that they will appear at their deportation hearings. But the people inside are treated exactly like prisoners. I visited the great big one in Arizona called Eloy Detention Center, which is the only one in Arizona that houses women. And I went there on a visiting day to visit this woman. I couldn't believe, I mean, I'm not familiar with criminal prisons either. So I went in there and I was shocked at the way that they treated the families. They sort of crowded them into this great big lobby. People had to wait for hours to visit their loved ones. The guards were yelling at the little kids. You know, one little boy was bored to tears. You know, he was playing on a gate, and this guard just yelled at him. I never saw anything like, oh, honey, are you here to visit your daddy today? You know, like most of us normally talk to little children like that in public. The whole thing was very, very harsh. And at this private prison, they also limit the family visits to very few hours. And by contrast, ICE, you know, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, has its own detention center a couple miles away in another town called Florence. And that place is run a lot better with family visits 7 days a week, all day long. The food is better. But we only run about something like 11 ourselves. Everything else is contracted out. And as we've been learning about the detention centers in Texas, they're poorly monitored. You know, that these companies are not necessarily complying with the regulations that they agree to when they get the contract.
Let me take a real quick break here and let people know that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Margaret Regan. She's the author of a great book called Detained and Deported, Stories of Immigrant Families Under Fire. The thing that got me, too, is like the point you were just making about these are civil prisons, and people are not – these people who are in these detention centers, a lot of them have already done jail time. They're not supposed to be doing any more jail time. A lot of the people who are in there weren't meant to do jail time, but – the idea, as you're saying, that this has suddenly become, these are actually prisons. And one of the things that was really shocking, I think, to me, because I know something about solitary confinement and the impact it has on people, there's a regular standard of solitary confinement for people who break the rules or who are being unruly. You know, this is disgusting.
I know. It's very shocking. You know, we condemn the use of solitary confinement. Remember those three hikers that wandered over into Iran a few years ago? Those Americans. And they were held in solitary. And the woman, I don't remember her name, who was one of them, when she got out of there, finally, she came back and wrote how debilitating it is and went on to make the very important point that, yes, we practice solitary confinement in our prisons in the United States. And shockingly, in these immigration detention centers. One of the women in my book that I interviewed, she was 61 years old, skewing pretty much older than, you know, the usual population there. And she told me she had these terrible anxiety attacks. She was a good living Catholic, you know, religious woman, worked hard all her life. It was so disturbing for her to be locked up in this tiny cell. She started having all these panic attacks and hive attacks. She kept going to the nurse at the Eloy Detention Center, and the nurse got angry at her for coming. And she said, if you come in here one more time, you will be placed in solitary, and that's as punishment for seeking medical care. And that woman finally said, just deport me. I cannot stand it anymore. And that's, you know, the criticism of these centers is that we allow them to be so harsh because that's what our goal secretly is. We don't want them to make use of the rights that we've afforded them to fight their case. We just want them out of here, and a lot of people just can't stand it. So they, you know, in a way, they self-deport.
It's heavy, too, because, you talked about Eloy, and then there's this other one that, and you know, which is sort of the garbage pail of the entire system, it seems, the one that was connected up.
Pinal County.
Yes, yes, yes.
That one was horrible, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That had been named one of the 10 worst. And even in the course of writing my book, I wrote all this stuff about it, and then all of a sudden ICE pulled their contract. It was so bad that even ICE couldn't tolerate it anymore.
You know, but what I was going to say is that in all these conditions, there's actually something that also I think people don't think about very much, and that is suicides and the suicides that are on the rise within these detention centers.
Right, yeah. Well, while I was writing this book, two young Guatemalans committed suicide in the Eloy Detention Center a few days apart. They both committed suicide, and neither one had even been there for very long. One was a young woman, one was a young man. And, you know, it came out that Eloy was not even abiding by the suicide prevention protocols that were set in place in their contract. And even more shocking, when ICE discovered that they weren't, the ICE statement was, we are negotiating with Corrections Corporation of America to bring their standards up to meet the legally required standard. And I'm thinking, negotiating? We're paying these people to do this job. The very least is we could insist that they abide by the conditions and the regulations. So, I mean, they did make changes after that. But, you know, there are a lot of people in despair up there. In Eloy, there are very many Guatemalan women who are seeking asylum, and they can be held for years. One woman I interviewed, when I haven't checked on her in a while, but she'd been there about 3 years, because they can keep appealing their cases. And, you know, this is what we've been hearing about these mothers and children in Texas. They're applying for asylum. They're applying for asylum as refugees, and yet we're housing them in these, you know, really appalling conditions when they're just asking under international law for asylum for their fear, you know, their fear of being in their home country.
You know, one of the things that the other part of your book, the other half of your book is on deportation. And one of the things that you bring out there that was really, I mean, it's just so moving in terms of how, again, people's lives. It's one thing you're picked up, you're shut down into these detention centers, you're separated off from everything, and many times the end result is being deported. And even after spending 6 years fighting to try and have some semblance of, okay, I can stay here, whatever. But the deportations and the brutal inhumanity that's unleashed with these deportations, I wanted to ask you very quickly about one person in particular that really stuck with me. I think her name is Elena Santiago.
Right. Uh-huh.
Very moving story, because I think it captures a lot of what happens to so many people.
Yeah. I mean, her story, you know, and she's still down there. She was a single mom with a teenager and a little toddler girl, and she was arrested by ICE at her house one morning. The kids were taken away from her and put in foster care with Child Protective Services because she had no family that they could go to. And she was deported within something like 24 hours of being picked up. She landed in Nogales, Sonora, which is the town right across from Nogales, Arizona, where they drop them off. she didn't have any identification with her, which proved to be a huge problem for her as time went on. She had no money. She had no extra clothes. She had nothing. She hadn't been in Mexico in 27 years, and here she lands in this town, which, you know, is kind of dangerous for a woman just hanging around on the streets. No idea what to do, where to go, no way to get in touch with her children. And her case, the only reason I know about her, I mean, there are many people like her that I don't know about who don't get help. An activist group located her, she found them, and they helped her get in touch with Child Protective Services and get on the phone, and she was able to speak to the children in foster care. But get this, she's in Nogales trying to rebuild her life, and the state of Arizona moves to sever her parental rights to the little girl, who was 2 or 3 at that point, because she was not an available mother. Because she was a deportee, she was not there to take care of her child. Therefore, she was an unfit mother. And the state moved to sever her parental rights to that little girl. The teenage boy was on his own. He can make the decision not to be adopted. But so she had to fight to maintain her parental rights to that child. So ultimately, she was able to get her back. But I witnessed the whole trial around this. It was on the phone. She wasn't allowed to attend the case, the hearing in Phoenix, because she's a deportee. So she's down there in Nogales on the phone, for Pete's sakes, and they're talking about whether or not they're going to remove her child from her permanently. And she was also not allowed to speak. She was only allowed to listen. And surprisingly, they did bring her the child back down there in Mexico. But she's really struggling down there. You know, she has this kid who's traumatized. They'd been apart for 14 months, and when they got back together, they didn't even speak the same language. The child no longer spoke Spanish, and the child is very disrupted. She became very attached to her foster mother, and she had a nicer place to live up in Phoenix. You know, now she's with a mother who's just scraping by in this kind of difficult Mexican city. So, yeah, it's a shocking thing how people are just dumped over there and they don't have any idea what to do.
You know, there's one thing, we have time for one last question for a few minutes, and I'll be quick with the question. You can, you know, do your answer. But the thing is the response, I think actually, you know, one of the things that really struck me too about another section of your book, which is called Resistance, and I felt that was so important and so inspiring, because similar to the situation where you have black and brown people being gunned down, wantonly gunned down all over the country just unbelievable numbers, and by the police and various other enforcers of authority here. But you also have, in this situation, you have people saying, we will not tolerate this any longer. And I was very inspired, particularly, I thought that the streamline example you gave was actually so good. It was,
wasn't that amazing?
Yo, it was great. It said, I'm sitting there going, yes, this is what we need more of on every front. We need more of this. You know? But give people just a sense of that. And then,
this is another interesting thing about immigration policy. They randomly select about 70 border crossers every day to prosecute, with the idea that if people hear on the other side that maybe they're going to end up in jail for crossing, usually they just get sent back, the early border crossers. So every day they randomly arrest 70 people, put them in the Border Patrol jail for a couple of days, and then they have these mass hearings before a federal judge. You've never seen anything like it in the United States. 70 people at once being tried. They come into the courtroom in chains and, handcuffed and chains around their feet. And they shuffle in, you know, it's like something out of the 18th century, seeing prisoners shuffled in like that. And they're all dirty and smelly from being in the desert. And they all plead guilty. They have a chance to meet with an attorney for 10 minutes a day. And they all plead guilty because, as one attorney said to me, it's all set up that way. If they plead not guilty, then they're going to be in prison for a lot longer because they're held there without bail until they can have a regular trial. So if they plead guilty, then they'll maybe be sent to jail for 3 months or 6 months, and then they'll get out. So they all plead guilty. They all say one by one, culpable, culpable. And then, you know, they're all convicted. So it's like a foregone conclusion every day, 70 people convicted in this mass trial. So a group of activists in Phoenix and in Tucson decided that they would stop the bus that brings the prisoners to the federal courthouse. And I mean, I didn't know anything about it beforehand. Somebody called me, tipped me off to go down there that day. I saw the whole thing. It was, you know, the whole operation was done with military precision. They knew the routes that the two buses took, and they blocked the roadways. You know, a human chain, people just got in front of the buses, and of course the bus driver has to stop. And then they had it all planned out, they chained themselves to the bus wheels so that they couldn't just arrest them and take them away easily. So it was just this amazing thing. They lay there on the ground for about 3 hours, changed these buses. And, you know, this is Arizona, and it was hot. They were out there in the sun. And the immigrants are all on the buses, you know, wondering what's going on. And, of course, they all got arrested. But it turned out they did stop the streamline hearings for that one day because there wasn't time for the immigrants to meet with their attorneys, which would have been unlawful. So they were very happy that they succeeded in canceling the hearings for that day. And as it happened, all those people were just let go. They were just deported instead of being tried and sentenced to a jail. So they were really happy. And by the way, their last of their court hearings was just a week or two ago. And the judge sentenced them to time served. They had all spent a night in jail. I think there were about 13 of them, people who got arrested. So they all were very happy. They felt, you know, had really been worth it bringing attention to the streamline hearings.
Yep. All right, Margaret Regan, thank you very much for joining us on the show today. And thanks a hell of a lot for a really great book.
Oh, thanks so much, Michael.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Take care. Talk to you again soon. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Margaret Regan, the author of Detained and Deported, Stories of Immigrant Families Under Fire. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Streets are paved with gold. You're diving underwater when you hear the hell of counter, knowing it's all been best and worth it if you run into patrols. Hiding in the shadows, so scared that you won't scream, but you dare not make a sound if you want to hold on to your dream.
Hold on. You may not be alive. Hold on.
No matter the consequences or the fear that grips your senses,
you have got to hold on to your dream.
City of the angels, with its bright light fascination, only adds to the confusion that your mind must now endure. The gringos take advantage when they know that you're illegal, but you avoid la policia like a plague that can't be cured. Paying the mordida, you find out just what oil means. You cannot file complaints if you want to hold on to your dream.
Hold on. May not be alive, but you hold on. Cause you know it's all you've got.
No matter the consequences or the fear that grips your senses,
you have got to hold on to your dream.
Back to your family, taking down Sarissa, where the lights are very low. Your mind may start to wonder when you think about your village. You're the woman that you love so much, who's still in Mexico. At just $2 an hour, there's little to redeem. This life accepted in your mind, you're trying to hold on to your dream.
Hold on.
No matter the consequences or the fear that grips your senses,
you have got to hold on to your dream. Yeah. Hold on. May not be your life, but hold on. Cause you know it's all you got.
No matter the consequences or the fear that grips your senses,
you have got to hold on.
Hold on.
May not be a lot, but hold on. Cause you know it's all you've got.
Welcome back. That was Gil Scott-Heron with Alien, Hold On to Your Dreams from his album 1980. Very moving, very soul-stirring, and very, very important for what's going on in the world today. All right, coming up now, I want people to hear this interview I did with a woman named Georgiana Williams. And this was done back in, I think, 2006. But it's still very, very, very appropriate for what's happening today. And Georgiana is the mother of Damian Williams, who was one of the L.A. Four, the four youth that were put on trial, convicted and jailed and condemned for the L.A. Rebellion. It was the system's way of hitting back at the L.A. Rebellion. They were arrested in the early hours of the rebellion for what happened at the corner of Florence and Normandy in Los Angeles. And a friend of mine had met Georgiana a little while before this interview took place. And she was talking with her about Georgiana's views on the relationship between black people in this country and immigrants. And this conversation took place at a time when the system was trying to stir up all kinds of hatred between black and brown people, between black people and immigrants in particular. So check out what Georgiana Williams has to say on this. Ms. Williams, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. On April 29th, you spoke at a rally, and you spoke very movingly about the situation with immigrant people and what you think the relationship between immigrant people and black people should be. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your belief?
I believe that we all should be treated as human beings. I lived in South Los Angeles for more than 40 years. And the area that I lived in, we have a lot of Spanish-speaking people. And if you go to Florence and Normandy, everybody knows I'm known as Grandma, not to just African-Americans, to everybody. And everyone, when I lived there, was welcome to my home. And I see what, I get very emotional today when I see what's going on with the Spanish-speaking people. Because, Micah, I grew up in the South in Mississippi on a plantation. And the same way the poor people live in Mexico, that's the way we lived in Mississippi. That's the way we was treated in Mississippi. It's 2006. It's time for a change. When I was growing up in Mississippi, I know what it's like to crawl on my knees all day long and pick 100 pounds of cotton and get 50 cents. I know what it's like to crawl on my knees all day long and pick up potatoes and peanuts and pulled tomatoes and bell pepper and cucumbers and watermelons and cantaloupes and get $3 a day. I know what it's like when they lock the schools and tell your parents that you can't go to school till all the work on the farm is done. My father left the plantation when I was 16. By the help of God, I did graduate from high school. I went to nursing school. I did well. And I left Mississippi and moved to California so I could work and help my family. I'm from a family of 13, so I say, leave these people alone. If they want to work in the field, if they want to work in the laundry, if they want to keep your babies, if they want to clean your house, if they want to work in your restaurant, if they don't have a green card, if they don't have a visa, leave them alone. Let them make an honest dollar and make a living. We shouldn't have to suffer in 2006 the way we suffered in the 50s and the 60s. Leave the people alone. Treat them as human beings. Treat them like you want to be treated yourself. And let them make a life for themselves. And let them make a living.
You know, now, Georgiana, one of the questions, very powerfully put, I'm sitting here, actually tears in my eyes around that, because, you know, when we first spoke, you said you don't even like calling people immigrants.
No.
You know, why not? Well, talk about that.
Okay. I used to hear my grandmama talk about the slave ship and how her grandmother told, they had a word for the slaves, but we're not going to say it on the air, okay, because it's very offensive. So to me, immigrant is like that word they used to use in the South for African-American people. I don't like it. Because, you see, I heard my grandma talk about how the plantation owner made them eat with the pigs. They put the food in the South. They feed the hogs out of this thing called a trough. And Big Mama used to say how that Mr. Hawk and them put the food in the trough and how they had to go out there and fight the hogs to eat. You know, all them people should be treated kind and humanity. All this bickering by green cards and visas, oh, they could just go to hell with it.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Georgiana Williams. Georgiana is the mother of Damian Williams, one of the L.A. Four, the four youth that were arrested at the opening hours of the L.A. Rebellion for activities on the intersection of Florence and Normandy. And they were punished as a way of slapping back at the people and the L.A. Rebellion. All right, coming up now, I'm very pleased to be bringing this to you. This is an excerpt from Bob Avakian. It's an excerpt from a speech of Avakian's, and it's included in a DVD called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And you can get that at revolutiontalk.net. All right, you can find that there. You can also find links to all of this on revcom.us. So check this out. This is called Why Do People Come Here from All Over the World?
Now I can just hear these reactionary fools saying, well, Bob, answer this. If this country is so terrible, why do people come here from all over the world? Why are so many people trying to get in, not to get out? Maybe we can imagine someone like Vice President Dick Cheney, that crooked mouth monster and worldwide mass murderer. Maybe we can imagine him saying something like this. Yes, Bob, why is that? Why? I'll tell you why. Because you have f***ed up the rest of the world even worse than what you have done in this country. You have made it impossible for many people to live in their own countries as part of gaining your riches and power. Besides everything else that I've mentioned, let's look at what they did in the Congo back in the early 60s and the effect this has had right up to today. The Congo used to be a colony of Belgium. It was the most brutal kind of colonization, working the people literally to death in the mines and other places. They worked them so viciously, literally like slaves, and if they didn't work hard enough, the overseers there would cut off the hands of the people. Finally, after World War II, the people of the Congo got rid of the domination and colonization by Belgium. And they set out to try to build a new country for themselves, and a leader emerged, Lumumba, who was a very popular leader among the people in the Congo. An election was held, and Lumumba won very clearly. But because he was setting out to overcome this legacy of colonialism and all domination by imperialism, the U.S. would not allow it. They maneuvered, they trapped him, they got him into a situation where he was taken and assassinated. And what did they do in place of Lumumba? What did they bring to the people of the Congo? Mobutu, a vicious, brutal tyrant backed by the U.S., kept in power for decades, plundering the people of his own country, building up and amassing tremendous wealth while the people were suffering worse and worse. And then they say, well, see, these people aren't ready for independence. They can't handle their own affairs. Look what happens when they get their independence. Yeah, look what happens. And look deeper and see why. To understand how this system works and how it controls and shapes people's lives, let's look at how people from Mexico and black people end up living alongside each other in somewhere like Watts in Los Angeles or New Jersey or New York City today. It's 1780 or 1800, and someone is walking through their home village in Africa. Maybe they're taking care of a few cattle. Maybe they're tending a few crops. Maybe they're just out for a walk and enjoying the sunny day in the summer. Whatever, all of a sudden they're grabbed and a rope is thrown around them. They're dragged away, never again to see their village or their loved ones. They're transported to a seacoast where they're sold to slave traders, thrown in the hold of a ship under the most horrific and unimaginable conditions, piled together. If you've ever seen drawings, diagrams of slave ships, people packed together, cargo, as they were called. Rats crawling over you day and night, slop at most to eat, never even allowed up on deck to even get any fresh air. If bad conditions arose on the seas, storms developed, the slave ship owners would go among the cargo, the human beings, and decide which one should be thrown overboard so they could save the rest of the cargo so they could make a profit. And through all that horror, you're finally brought to the Americas. Have everything stripped away from you, even your identity. Forced to slave, the people forced to slave away for generations. As the old saying goes, from can't see in the morning till can't see at night. After all the unbelievable horror of what I just described on the slave ship, the Middle Passage, for millions, where millions and perhaps tens of millions died, and those who survived were subjected to these unbelievable conditions of slavery. After generations and centuries of that, finally comes the Civil War. You're promised an end to oppression. You're promised you'll get land and a means for farming the land, 40 acres and a mule. But the promise is broken. After a few years of Reconstruction, in which a few people got some rights and a little bit of land and property, people were stripped of all that and subjected to all the kind of terror and lynching that I've talked about here. This goes on also for generations. The KKK and the rest of it, forcing you to remain on the plantations, terrorizing you into working for the man, being cheated even when you do work. Finally, after World War II, you're driven off the land. You seek a better life. You go to the city or you go to the north. And what do you face? Once again, betrayal. You are segregated once again, terrorized now by the police. You end up in a housing project that's being allowed and deliberately constructed to rot away. In ancient Mexico, in the beginning of the 1500s, the Spanish conquistadores arrive in what they call the New World. The Spanish conquerors destroy the old ways of life and work people to death in the mines and on plantations called haciendas. This old way of life was not free of exploitation and oppression and plunder, but the Spanish did not come to liberate the people or to do away with exploitation, oppression, and plunder. They came to institute their own, an even worse and far more vicious form of exploitation and plunder, literally working people to death in the mines and on the haciendas, destroying their culture, taking away everything from them. About 150 years ago, after Mexico became independent from Spain, the U.S. waged war on Mexico and stole a large part of its territory. One of the main reasons for this is that the slave owners in the southern U.S. needed more land. The U.S. replaced Spain and other European colonial powers as the force dominating and plundering Mexico. The Mexican Revolution in the early part of the 1900s promised land to the peasants, but there was never a fundamental change, and the masses of people were still trapped in a situation of being exploited as poor peasant farmers while their country is plundered by the U.S. Throughout the 20th century, and even more so in recent years, the ever greater domination of farming in Mexico by big American agricultural companies has ruined the livelihood of millions of more peasant farmers in Mexico who were already living in poor and desperate conditions, but were driven further into such desperate conditions, so much so that they could no longer survive by farming. The Mexican government goes into more and more debt to big banks and financial institutions in the rich countries, especially the U.S., and then, at the insistence of the U.S., it cuts off aid to the peasants who are still trying to survive by farming in Mexico. In effect, the government forces them to grow crops that get sold internationally on what is called the world market, which is controlled by the rich countries and their financial institutions. But the Mexican peasants cannot compete in this world market. They cannot make a living. They can barely survive, if they can survive at all, by farming. Writing in our party's newspaper, The Revolutionary Worker, in 1994, shortly after an uprising in Chiapas, in the southern part of Mexico, Michael Slate gave a sharp example of this. He wrote about how what has happened to Mexican agriculture over the past 30 years. Now, agri means having to do with the land. So agriculture is a way of life based on the land. Slate described how over the last 30 years, Mexican agriculture has been greatly damaged by even more deeply mixed in with and dependent on the world market. Peasant farmers growing things not for their own needs and not necessarily for what is needed in Mexico itself, but what can be sold to big buyers all over the world. Once again, a world market dominated by companies controlling billions of dollars. Deeply in debt and under pressure from the World Bank, which itself is dominated by the U.S., the Mexican government promoted crops that could be sold on the world market in order to try to pay off this debt that it was sinking deeper and deeper into. Land and resources were shifted away from basic food production, and the results have been a disaster for the peasants. In Chiapas, for example, most peasants used to grow corn and beans, but over the years, many switched to growing coffee for export. When the price of coffee fell on the world market in 1990, thousands of Mexican peasants were ruined. And in a recent issue of our newspaper, the RW, there's another article detailing more fully how imperialist domination from the U.S. through things like NAFTA and other ways have further ruined the peasants in Mexico. Another thing mentioned in that article is the maquiladoras in Mexico, just inside the border with the U.S. These are factories that are set up by U.S. companies. They move away from the U.S. and put them just over the border in Mexico. And that line there, that border, is the difference between wages that are 10 times higher on the U.S. side and 10 times lower on the Mexico side. And who works in these maquiladoras? People who can no longer live in the interior, in the countryside, on the farmlands of Mexico, and especially many women who are not only brutally exploited, but also sexually harassed on the job, and many have been murdered coming to and from the job in these border areas. But even that's not enough. Now many of the maquiladoras are being closed down on the border, while some new ones are being built further in the interior of Mexico in order to take advantage of people who are impoverished there. And still others are being moved to other places in Asia and elsewhere where people can be worked for even lower wages because they're even more desperate. So through all this, you find yourself having to leave your home and your homeland in Mexico to go to El Norte, the USA, where you face discrimination and exploitation, living in fear every day of the immigration police, La Migra, if you don't have the necessary papers. You too end up in Watts, or in New York City, or New Jersey, or other cities in the U.S. In the early 80s, there was a movie starring Jack Nicholson and Elpidia Carrillo called The Border, which dramatically showed the kinds of hardships that drive people and the promises and illusions that call them to cross the border from Mexico into the U.S. And it showed the hardships they suffer once they come to the U.S., the ways in which they are treated as aliens, and how they are exploited and brutalized in so many ways. The following lines from the theme song of that movie give a powerful sense of what this means. The bitter disappointment that is found in the so-called promised land of the USA, and the many ways in which people are still hemmed in by the visible and invisible borderline. Now, my voice is hoarse, but I'm going to give this a try. There's a land, so I've been told. Every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline. And when it's time to take your turn, here's a lesson you must learn. You will lose more than you'll ever hope to find. And when you reach the broken promised land, every dream slips through your hand. And you'll know it's too late to change your mind. 'cause you paid the price to come this far, just to wind up where you are, and you still just across the borderline. For oppressed people who have been through all this, what sense does it make to fight over the crumbs the oppressors leave us? Or to fight for control of things we can never really control under this system, including the very neighborhoods we live in, the neighborhoods they have forced us into while they run these neighborhoods down? What sense does it make to fight each other like that when we are part of the same class of exploited and oppressed people who can rise up together to put an end to all this? There is a whole long and bitter history in this country and all over the world of the oppressors getting one people they are oppressing to fight against another, all for the benefit of the oppressors themselves. Think about the experience of the Buffalo Soldiers. Bob Marley wrote a song about this. Danny Glover made a movie about it. But the reality is that these were soldiers, black soldiers, who after the Civil War wanted to prove that they were loyal Americans, that they would earn their place now that they won their so-called freedom. And what were they put to doing? Slaughtering the native peoples, finishing them off in their own home territories, carrying forward the genocide against the native peoples and the theft of their land and the resources in their land. It's a bitter lesson. On the other side of the picture, you have the experience of the Cherokees in America. Back in the 1800s, Old Hickory, Andrew Jackson, the great example of American democracy in evidence as president of the United States, and by the way, a slave owner, convinced some of the leaders of the Cherokees that they could get in on all the goodness of America, and he allowed them to purchase plantations. And they even went ahead and purchased slaves and ran slave plantations. But then a few years later, Andrew Jackson and those who ruled the U.S. decided the land was too valuable for Cherokees to have it. So they were driven out of there and sent on a horrific march toward Oklahoma, a death march where especially old people and children died by the wayside, what became known as the Trail of Tears. Another bitter lesson. But the greater lesson is this. We have reached the point in human history and the development of human society where we don't have to be trapped in this kind of situation and played like this anymore. We have the basis. We have the basis not only to unite those who are oppressed under this system, but to sweep away all this garbage they want to keep getting us caught up in. To sweep away the source of all this, their system itself. Now next, I'm going to get into how all these things flow from the very nature of this system and why it cannot be reformed. It must be done in and done away with. We need a revolution, the most radical revolution in the history of humanity. And I'm going to be talking about what this revolution is all about. But first, it's time for a break and intermission.
All right, you've just been listening to Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, talking about why do people come here from all over the world. And again, you've been listening to an excerpt of a speech given by Bob Avakian, and it was made into a film, a DVD called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. You can access that entire DVD at revolutiontalk.net, and you can also find links to it at revcom.us. So check that out. All right, that just about brings us to the end of yet another show, and I'm very pleased that we went through the show together because it was a hell of a show, all right? I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you for tuning in.
If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com, all right? And we're going to go out now with a song that I just really felt like playing in the wake of all this. It's from Willie Nelson. It's called Across the Borderline. Talk to you next week.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline. When it's time to take your turn, here's a lesson that you must learn. You could lose more than you'll ever find. When you reach the broken promised land, when every dream slips through, your mind, 'cause you paid the price to come so far just to wind up where you are, and you're still just across the borderline. Up and down the Rio Grande, a thousand footprints in the sand reveal a secret no one can define. The river flows on like a breath between our life and death. Who's the next to cross the borderline?